This is an interview with Mark Sisitsky for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive on the History of Financial Regulation. Today is June 22nd, 2011. I'm James Stoker. We're talking at Mark's office at Jones Day in New York City. Mark, welcome.
Pleased to be here.
Yeah. So I'd like to start at the beginning. Where were you born and where did you grow up?
I grew up born and raised in Springfield, Massachusetts.
Okay. Were your parents lawyers?
My father was a police officer. My mother was a homemaker.
So neither was involved in securities or business in any way?
Hardly.
Okay. So how did you end up at Dartmouth, and what did you study there?
I ended up at Dartmouth because I played basketball and was one of the schools that I was recruited at. And when I got there, I ended up being a government major.
So, did you already know at that time that you were going to go to law school?
No.
Did you start law school right after your undergraduate degree?
Yes. It was a process of elimination. I wasn't really interested in anything else, and I had a draft board that was very interested in me. So, at that time, at least, I decided to go to law school.
Did you know at the beginning of your law school days that you would end up focusing on corporate and securities law?
No.
Okay. How did you come to be interested in that area, or was it just sort of by default again?
By default. I once said to somebody, my whole legal career has been serendipity, just going from just by chance and opportunity, going from one thing to another. Been very rewarding, very interesting, but not very well planned.
Were there any specific professors there that you'd like to mention that maybe had an influence on you or shaped the way that your career went?
I had some excellent professors, but no one really shaped my career.
This was at the University of Michigan, right?
Yes.
I don't think I mentioned that.
Yes.
Yeah. So after law school, did you begin right away at Carter, Ledyard & Milburn?
Yes.
Where was that located?
Carter, Ledyard & Milburn is located at 2 Wall Street. It's been there and is still there. It's been there for like 125 years, as I recall, at this point.
So you were in New York City, not in Washington, D.C.?
Yes.
All right. And were you working on any issues related to the bond market at this time?
Actually, I was doing corporate transactions, and in the process, we were representing a client called United States Trust Company of New York. The United States Trust Company in New York was representing, did a lot of trustee work as well as other types of loans and financings. And I got involved in a matter that they were acting as trustee for the New York Port Authority, a bi-state organization. And in the process of representing them, U.S. Trust Company, the two states retroactively repealed a covenant that effectively kept the Port Authority out of financing for mass transit. I think it could only spend $25 million a year on PATH and the New York subways. And when it was retroactively repealed, there was approximately about $10 billion of bonds, tax-exempt bonds outstanding, which had relied on this covenant. And so the trustee determined to sue the states of New York and New Jersey separately, and I became involved in that. For about 2 years, I moved over from being a corporate lawyer to being more of a litigator, and it was great fun. We actually had a 5-day trial in Hackensack, New Jersey, against the state of New Jersey. Then it was appealed to the New Jersey Supreme Court, and then ultimately it went to the U.S. Supreme Court. By that time, I was at the New York Securities Rulemaking Board, but was invited to attend the Supreme Court hearing, and ultimately in a 4-3 decision, the Supreme Court concluded that the two states had violated the U.S. contract clause and that the repeal of the mass transit covenant was not permissible. It was the first contract case since the 30s. It was very, very interesting. At that was my introduction to the industry, and was in the course of that matter, I got to interview a number of the leading members of the industry and became very familiar not only with the how the industry traded, sold, and underwrote municipal securities, but also some of the personalities that were involved.
Okay. Now, this was the era of the near bankruptcy of New York City in 1974, which was linked to the city's inability to sell its municipal bonds. Did your work touch on that at all, or was this a completely separate issue with the Board of Authority?
Totally separate issue. Totally separate issue.
But you watched this from up close?
The New York City
issue.
I was very familiar and I knew some of the people that were involved in it, yes.
Okay, but you weren't personally working on that at the time.
No.
All right. And around this time, another major issue that was going on were a series of bond scandals in the late 1960s and 70s that were committed by different organizations in Tennessee and Arkansas. Was this something that affected your work at all? Or?
Yes. I mean, that was, as far as I'm concerned, that was the reason that the MSR, Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board, was created. The only reason it was created. The shorthand name for it was Memphis Bond Dealers, and what they had done that got the ire of Congress was that they had defrauded the returning POWs from the Vietnam War, who had significant back pay accrued, and they went to them and said, "We, would, you know, a number of cases that testify the testimony that we read." To the effect that we'll invest your money at no cost to you, at which point they put them in unrated, very dangerous tax-exempt paper, and they all lost, some of them lost all or most of the money that they had accrued while they were prisoners of war. So, you know, Congress reacted very strongly to that development, and they created the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board.
Mm-hmm. While you were working on the Port Authority bonds issue, were you following the deliberations in Congress at all?
Not really. I really never thought it was going to affect me. I thought it was just I'd be at college for forever, and really didn't pay much attention to it, except to share everybody's reaction to what had happened. But it was just more as an observer. Certainly had no interest in it as a from a professional perspective.
So how did you go from being a practicing lawyer who was happened to be working on a bond issue, or a bonds-related issue, to becoming the counsel of the MSRB?
At Cottle Ledger, my colleagues for several years was a woman named Frieda Wallison. And Frieda and I were good friends there, and it turns out that when a whole series of happenstances, but her husband was very close to Nelson Rockefeller, and when Agnew was removed from office or resigned as vice president, Rockefeller was named vice president. And he brought Peter Wallace and Frieda's husband down to Washington as general counsel. And so Frieda went down there and started working at the Securities and Exchange Commission, and she was instrumental in the creation of the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board. So just by chance, one time she was back in New York, and she was just, you know, visiting friends at Cottle Ledger and stopped in to say hi, and we were talking. And she was telling me what she was doing. I said, geez, that sounds exciting. And she said, well, if you think so, I've got a spot for you. And I said, whoa, let me think about that. And, you know, the ultimately decided to join Frieda at the MSRB and went down to Washington. I think not only I, but I think even the board members, and certainly Frieda, but certainly the board members, we all thought that this would take a year or two at the most to write the rules, and that then the MSRB would be merged into the NASD or something else, somebody else. and that we would all, you know, we would be done with our work. So I even considered, I had a wife and two young children, I even considered, you know, keeping our New York apartment, and I would just commute on weekends. We decided not to, and we went down to Washington, like so many people in Washington. We went down there for a year or so, and we ended up staying there for 30. So.
Okay. So when you got involved in this project, the law had already been passed, and the board members already been selected?
When I got there, it was like 6 or 8 months after the MSIB had been created. The board members had been selected. We had temporary quarters in Washington for offices.
Where were they at?
Oh, I think they were at 1729 K Street or something, my recollection. Let's see, Frieda, I think, there was another executive director who I don't remember his name, but he was only there for a very short time before Frieda became executive director and general counsel. We had started up. I don't think any rules had been passed, although everything was being worked on.
Mm-hmm. How many staff members were there when you got there?
I think I may have been the third of, actually maybe the fourth. I was probably the fourth.
Mm-hmm. And then over that first year, you probably hired a few more?
We did hire a couple more. We didn't grow that fast.
Okay. When the organization was created, did it already have a budget and things like that, or was there already financing available, or how did it pay for its staff?
I think one of the first things we did was we were empowered to raise money from the industry, and we proceeded to do that. As far as the interim funding, I don't recall.
Okay. Just ask you a little bit about the board members at the time. Did you know any of the board members already?
I knew of some of them through the litigation that I had been involved in at the Port Authority.
Okay. Yeah. Now, at this time, the board had 15 members. There were 5 from banks, 5 from non-bank security dealers, and 5 mm-hmm. public representatives. Mm-hmm. I understand that on the initial board, there wasn't a single member from dealers that dealt but municipal bonds, or small dealers.
I'm not sure that's right.
Oh, no?
There were a couple of representatives from relatively small dealers. There was Tom Matheson from Underwood Newhouse, which was a regional dealer in Texas. I think there was a fellow named, his name was Bill Rex from a firm called Foster & Marshall out in Seattle, which was another regional firm. So I think there were some representations of mm-hmm. smaller firms at the time.
At the beginning, was the securities industry, so bond dealers and everyone else involved in it, generally supportive of the MSRB?
I don't think they were excited about us being there.
No?
No, I think, it was a mix. It was a whole new experience for them. It was kind of interesting. It was really first time they'd ever been subject to regulation. There were some very basic issues that people were still contending about. For example, there were some people who didn't think that 10b-5 applied to sales of municipal securities, only supposed to be taxable securities. They were disabused by that for a number of cases that were developed in the years following, but It was a whole new experience, and you know, if you ask anybody from the industry, would you rather be regulated or unregulated? I think most of them would have said no, we'd rather be unregulated. But I think there were a lot of responsible people in the industry who saw the need for regulation, and if they weren't excited by it, they were at least willing to support it.
Mm-hmm. There were a few different statutory limitations on the board's power. One of these was the so-called Turner Amendments.
Tower.
The Tower Amendments. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Could you tell me a little bit about those?
The MSIB was a great compromise. It was, I think, created directly to address the abuses that we've referenced before in the sales of securities to unsuitable sales to to POWs, etc. But the grand compromise was there were a number of forces involved. The 5-5 and 5 division, I think, from my experience, was due to the fact that the banks did not want to be regulated by the Securities and Exchange Commission. So they wanted to be certain that they had requisite bank regulatory supervision would continue, even though the SEC oversaw everything. So you had that division between the securities dealers and the banks, and then you had the issuers who were, you know, who had the ears of Congress, because there's, you know, lots of issuers in every state. They certainly didn't want new disclosure requirements put on them, and so that was put in to protect the issuers against regulations that could affect them directly.
Okay. But the law did require municipal securities dealers to register with the SEC and to comply with a number of requirements for securities dealers. So they had to do new things like comply with net capital requirements. Was there resistance from the industry to this?
Not once the legislation was passed.
Okay. Basically accepted it.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So in those early days, how did the MSRB go about setting its rules? Did board members tend to draft them, or did staff members draft them and the board approve them, or was it a back-and-forth deal?
Back-and-forth deal, I think, would be the most accurate. The board was very lucky in that, you know, sometimes you have the right person at the right time, and Frieda Wallison was just a very strong and very intelligent regulator who understood what the board needed to do in order to get off the ground, and she was a great leader. I think that was not only on the, you know, on drafting, etc., but also I think the board really developed a lot of confidence in her judgment, and so she became, I think, you know, probably the most important person at the on the board staff ever. She, because it was brand new blackboard that she was writing on, and the board was writing on, and she. She had a lot of tremendous leadership, and the board by no means delegated to staff. It was an interactive process. They had strong views on things, and they, you know, they let their views be known, and it was a lot of back and forth. And the board worked very hard. I mean, the first year, these were all very senior people in their organizations. There were months where we would meet 3, 4, 5 days and work all day, and it was very intense for the first year, or even more than the first year and a half or so, when we were getting, you know, all the basic rules in place.
Mm-hmm. The board members, of course, kept their own jobs, their own day jobs, right?
Yes.
How often did you have these meetings? Were they every month, or were they?
Well, that's what I said. It was.
Yeah, okay.
It was, you know, in some months it was twice a month. You know, we ultimately, after a couple of years, it was like at least, you know, things got more orderly, and it got to a more like a quarterly basis. But often they were committee meetings, and mm-hmm. they were conference calls. It was extraordinary how much time the initial board spent on this matter, and they took it very seriously.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about some of the specific rules that were put out in these early days. One of the first proposals was put out in December 1975, and it had a number of different aspects, but one of them was mandating that certain employees in bond dealerships would have to pass an examination. How did the industry feel about that?
I think... Once the legislation was passed, that was not one of the more controversial issues. I think, you know, qualification of professionals in the industry just followed naturally because if you were in the securities industry on the equity side, you had your Series 7 and the other exam. So I don't think there was, you know, that was particularly controversial.
Who wrote the exams?
That was interesting. We on staff worked with the Educational Testing Service out of Princeton to formulate questions, and they were very helpful because, you know, we knew what issues, what matters we wanted covered, but in writing questions is really, you know, not an easy task in formulating those questions so they weren't ambiguous, etc. But the staff of the MSRB was intimately involved in that. We also, as I recall, we also formed committees from representatives of the industry. So it wasn't just staff. It was representatives of the industry who were on the question writing committees. So that, you know, it was a group effort.
So how long did it take to put the test together?
I do not
couple years?
Recall. I think it certainly took a couple of years to put the, and then it was an ongoing basis as questions were culled and new questions were put on.
So because this was a new exam and a new requirement, did that mean that in some cases people with many years of experience in the bonds industry would have to take the exam?
You know, it wasn't a very controversial thing. But I do think there was a grandfather provision, and I just don't remember how it operated. It's certainly not everybody in the industry had to take it. I think I just don't remember how the grandfather provisions worked.
Okay. We talked a little bit earlier about the decision to levy fees on the industry. I think it was 5 cents for every $1,000 in securities that were underwritten. Was the industry in general okay with this, or was that seen as a lot?
I think there was pushback. If I recall right, there were two fees. One, you paid a fee just because you were a dealer in the industry, an annual fee, and then there was a volume fee for underwriting. And I think there was, you know, some intense discussion about whether that fell on everybody the same. I'm sure it was worked out by the board. Our board members to try to make it as fair as possible, but there were actually two different fees, it was a balancing act.
Did the board have any problems with its budget in the early years, or did it go pretty smoothly?
I think it went pretty smoothly.
Okay. Yeah. Another proposal that the board put out in the early days dealt with record keeping. It required firms to keep records of purchases and sales of securities as well as individual accounts. Mm-hmm. Do you recall any resistance to this, or did it go over smoothly?
That was probably a little more controversial because everybody at that point had their own record keeping, and what the board was striving for is to create rules that would make them uniform. The reason they were trying to make them uniform is because, you know, the actual enforcement of these rules, along with the grand compromise that I mentioned, the actual enforcement of these rules were left to five different organizations. And they wanted to be able to, you know, some conformity among the different type of entities that were being regulated. And so that was an issue.
Did the board tend to divide up along, sectional lines when it dealt with these issues? So was there ever a case when the bank representatives would take one position and then the public representatives would take another, or did it tend to mix up a little bit?
It mixed up. There were several different dynamic forces involved in the formulation of the rules. There was the basic banks versus securities firms. They operated differently, and they had different reactions to proposals. But then there was a dichotomy between big organizations and small organizations. And that cut across. That was not necessarily a function of the type, whether you were a bank or not. It was a question of, were you a major underwriter or not, or, you know, were you a regional dealer? They had those, I think, suffused their roles, suffused some of their positions on some of the more difficult issues that the board had to address.
Okay. I'm going to cover just a couple more specific rules from this period that are
sure.
of interest. There was a proposal for something called a bona fide offering period, designed to give public investors a chance to buy securities at the same price. Can you explain a little bit what that was?
It's a rule called G11, and I have not in the last 15 or 20 years been really active in municipal regulation, but I find it amusing that some of the things that the board wrestled with in those very early years are still being contended to date. So we're talking 75, we're talking almost 30 years later. The same issues are still there. it really was a question of who has access to bonds during an underwriting period. And there was a, certainly, when you, this is one of those issues where if you were a small dealer, et cetera, you often didn't feel you got your fair allocation, which meant that your retail customers didn't get their fair allocation. So that was a very contentious rule, which the board got significant. Every rule was put out for comment, and significant amount of comments were delivered, were received in respect to that rule. I understand, I saw recently, maybe in the last couple of years, that it's, you know, it's up for reconsideration again. And so it's, you know, it's constantly, it's a rule that's constantly being modified and addressed, but that was a very controversial issue.
Do you recall how the board felt about the rule? Was it divided up between the big dealers and the small dealers or the banks and the securities brokers?
It was. I mean, it was very interesting. I think the board members, they certainly came with their own prejudices, given what their role. They were leaders of their firms, and this was revenue that was at stake for them. So it was, you know, it was an important issue. At the same time, I have to say that my recollection, I was you know, constantly somewhat surprised that the number of them could look at it from an industry perspective. From the perspective of what is the best for the industry, what is the right thing. Not saying that they necessarily totally divorce themselves from their own interests, but they did try to take the bigger view, and when comments came in, they really tried to balance things. They tried to come up with a balanced consensus position.
Another proposal during this period was to only require a part of a bank to register as a securities dealer instead of the entire legal unit. Was that a controversial issue at all? Or
not from the bank's perspective. That was, you know, I think that was just, you know, just goes with, you know, banks are huge organizations into all kinds of businesses, and they felt very strongly that they did not, since the SEC was the overseer of all of these, of all the organizations, and could come in and do their own examinations. They wanted to be very clear that the only areas that the bank that the was subject to the SEC oversight were the ones that were directly involved in the underwriting, sale, and trading of your securities. So it was a natural. I don't think there was a controversial within this dealer community. The question just was, you know, who is involved in that unit, and the. It then sometimes spilled over into other issues, and that is, you know, the gifts and gratuities. If, you know, some other part of the bank was making gifts to political individuals, office holders, you know, can that, you know, was that influencing what business they got? So, but for the most part, it was not controversial within the board at all.
Okay. I'm going to ask you about the SEC here in just a minute. Just a couple last questions about rules. In September 1977, the MSRB issued a rule that required municipal securities underwriters to disclose whether they had a financial advisory position with municipalities. Do you recall that being an issue?
Huge. A very, very controversial issue. It's also, you know, currently an issue. It's constantly brought up. I think they have, again, I have not followed what they've done recently. Every once in a while I read in the trade press or public newspapers this is an issue that they're wrestling with. I think the SEC is taking it up in other contexts about financial advisors acting as financial advisors. I think the solution, I mean, part of the problem was that, you know, you had your pure financial advisors who did no underwriting at all. And then you had and it wasn't necessarily size, because a lot of the regional firms also provided financial advisory services. They would act as financial advisors and then would switch over and act as underwriters. And so how do you address this issue? And I think the board at the time decided that it was a disclosure issue that you needed to disclose, and I think they had to do it in writing and get some acknowledgement from the issuer that that they had received and understood what they had received.
Did this affect a lot of underwriters?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So it was a very controversial issue, and I think it was one of the issues that received significant volume of comments from the industry.
Okay. So the MSRB did not see itself as having an enforcement function.
It had no enforcement function. Mm-hmm. The legislation was very clear that the enforcement was to reside in the three bank regulatory agencies for their banks for which they had principal supervisory responsibility, the NASD and the SEC.
But in June 1979, the SEC approved a rule that allowed the MSRB to penalize dealers who ran false or misleading advertising. Do you recall that?
That can't be.
No? Okay, that might be something.
I mean, it may have been a rule. Yeah. It may have been a rule that said that if you, you know, that you could not. The way it would have been formulated is that you had to have truth in advertising,
uh-huh.
But it would not be
the MSRB.
The MSRB that would enforce it. It would be enforced by the five regulatory agencies.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes. The MSRB had absolutely no one on its staff that had any examination or enforcement authority.
Okay. Yeah. We were just talking about the SEC in regards to a couple of these questions. In general, how would you describe the MSRB's relations with the SEC during these years?
I mean, the formal process is that the MSRB would propose rules, obtain comments from the industry, and do a ruling filing with the SEC. And then the SEC would comment on either approve or comment and ask the MSRB to review it. So I think there was always some tension between the MSRB and the SEC, because the MSRB really felt, and I think were accurate in their conclusion, that they knew more about the MSRB, more about the municipal securities industry than did the SEC. That was a fact. The SEC, though, felt that, you know, they had a larger mandate to follow than the MSRB, and so oftentimes there would be disagreements as to the substance of the rules, which were, for the most part, amiably worked out.
Okay. Were most of the communications between the SEC and the MSRB done by the staff or directly between the board members and the SEC, or how did that work?
I think they were mostly done between the staff of the SEC and staff of the MSRB, but there were periodic meetings of either the chairman of the MSRB with the chairman of the SEC, etc. And there was on occasion there would be meetings between the board and some of the senior staff of the SEC. I remember one meeting of particular interest which I think caused some irritation among the board members. The board members were senior officers of their respective banks, etc. And we had a meeting with the enforcement division of the SEC in the board's offices. And the head of the enforcement at that time was Stanley Sporkin, who was certainly well known on the street. And I think the consensus among the board members is he fell asleep, and it was not it's humorous from this perspective, but I don't think it was appreciated at the time.
No, I can certainly imagine that. did the SEC often push the MSRB to adopt perhaps more forceful rules than it otherwise might have been inclined to?
The MSRB, again, I'm talking, I can't talk subsequent to my tenure, but I think there was always that tension. But the board really viewed itself as independent regulators, and would try to work with the SEC to reach a mutual point of agreement, but at times would not, you know, would not write rules that it did not think were appropriate for the industry.
All right. Following the New York City bankruptcy crisis, several attempts were made to pass legislation that would require municipalities to file with the SEC under certain circumstances. These never really went anywhere, but organizations like the Municipal Finance Officers Association resisted these efforts. Did the MSRB ever take a position on those type of issues?
No. I mean, the MSRB took seriously the constraints in the statute that created it. And I don't think they even voiced an opinion, because although individuals on the board had strong views, they didn't think it was appropriate for the board to take a position.
In 1977, the SEC released its well-known report on the New York City crisis. Do you recall how this was received by municipal bond dealers and by the board?
The board, I do remember, we studied the report and tried to see if there was anything in there that should, that we, that the board should consider in its rulemaking activities. And I don't think, because so much of it went to disclosure and the inadequacy of disclosure, and since we had the Tower Amendment, there wasn't a lot that we thought that we could do.
If you recall the specifics, just speaking as an individual, what did you think of the report?
And I don't recall. I thought the report was well written. I think that it was also very low hanging fruit. I mean, the 1 or 2 page disclosure on the city of New York was obviously inadequate to form an opinion as to whether to make an investment or not. So I don't think anybody really was disputing that. Beyond that, I don't remember. It's a Mr. History, sort of. I would have to take a look at it again, but I think everybody thought it was a pretty good job.
The municipal bond industry tends to think of itself as kind of a clean industry, one that hasn't had a whole lot of scandals, yet this report was fairly critical of it. Do you think it was hitting on something there?
The municipal securities industry, At the time, it was a relatively small industry, and I think that the people did pride themselves at least on their intra-action among themselves. Trades were done before phone calls were recorded, etc., and for the most part, among the responsible traders, responsible members of the industry, trades were done over the telephone, and they were honored. And they took great pride in the fact that they were able to deal with each other on that basis. As to disclosure from issuers, you know, I think it was the industry was evolving, and I think a lot of people understood that. And I don't remember with any more precision what the reaction was.
Now, around this time, of course, the bond industry was growing throughout the decade and the decades that followed, but at the end of the 1970s, the passage of Proposition 13 in California that limited property taxes and similar measures in other states increased the number of bonds that were offered pretty dramatically. Did this impact the MSRB's work at all?
I don't think so. I mean, again, most of those things went to the impact that on the disclosure documents that would be used in selling bonds. I mean, how do you analyze what the new restrictions would have on the ability of issuers, both statewide and countywide in California, to pay their bonds on time. And this was, again, disclosure, which was beyond the mandate of the board. So there's really nothing that they could do.
Okay. Well, before we move on, do you have any other thoughts about your period at the MSRB?
It turned into like 4 years. 5 years, just about, and it was an interesting time to be at the startup of a new organization, and I was impressed by the fact of the seriousness of purpose that the board members brought to their responsibilities. It wasn't. It was everything was taken very seriously. I mean, we also had a lot of fun. I mean, there were a lot of characters on that board. And there were a lot of laughs, and there were a lot of ongoing, relationships and jokes. And it was an interesting experience. But the central to it was the seriousness of purpose that they brought to what they were doing.
Would you like to talk at all about the staff at the MSRB?
I think the staff, I think the MSRB in those early years was very fortunate to have the staff that it had. And they also deserve credit for putting it together as they did. Frieda Rawlison was a tremendous leader and earned their respect. And it was very unusual at that time to have a woman leading an organization. I know that sounds strange, but when I was leaving Carter Ledger, when I told them, and I actually took a leave of absence from Carter Ledger, when I told them that, a number of my friends who knew Frieda very well came up to me and said, geez, that should be interesting, but are you going to have a problem working for a woman? And, I wasn't a great feminist or anything, but my reaction was, she's a better lawyer than me. I'm going to learn a lot from her. She's a great lawyer. And indeed, she proved to be that. She was just a great executive director and general counsel. And I think the board, to their credit, appreciated her contributions and her skills. And she was critical in giving the board direction and moving it forward. And we had some other people. We had a fellow named Don Donahue, who was in the back office of a securities firm, a broker's broker in New York. And Don was the most knowledgeable person in terms of operations and all of the board's rules on record keeping and trading and sales practices, etc. We all looked to Don for guidance on that. And he became the face of the board and talking to the industry across the country on these rules, and earned tremendous respect. And it's actually proven that it was another proven commodity, because he's now CEO of the Depository Trust Company and is leading that organization through all the changes that the industry is seeing in terms of trading and settling transactions, as well as derivative transactions. And Don just was an invaluable member of that staff. And then, Richard Nesson, who followed me, became general counsel for DTC. So it really really had a good staff. There was a couple of other people. There's a fellow named Brent Wright, who became a partner at Wilkie Farr, and he made significant contributions also.
Okay. So in 1980, you left the MSRB and joined Keetac Rock. Did you stay in Washington?
Yes, it was really strange. I had enough of regulation, and I hate to say this, wanted to get back to the real world. And there was a fellow a board member, one of the original board members, who I had become very close to, named Dick Keyser. He was head of municipal finance at Citibank. And one day we were talking, I told him I was about to move on, and he said, don't wait, let me make a phone call. And he called, it was Keetac Rock, he called Bob Keetac, with whom Citibank did a lot of business, and he and Keetac had a good relationship. And 3 weeks later, I had an offer from Keetac Rock, and I moved on to Keetac Rock. And it was a natural transition for me at the time, because I had been immersed in municipal finance, knew a lot of people, and it had traveled around the country, you know, talking to bond clubs in different places. Mm-hmm. And QTech Rock, that was basically their main business. And so it was a relatively easy transition for me to move over.
So you knew Bob QTech?
I knew Bob QTech. He was a very interesting character, and I was lucky to have known him and to have worked closely with him.
He was well known for his work to improve the legal profession's ethical standards, I believe.
Right. He was the chairman of something called the QTech Commission, which rewrote the ethical rules for lawyers.
Okay. So tell me a little bit about the role of bond counsel at this time. Has it changed much since then, or is it pretty much the same thing?
I did a lot of work for one of the reasons it's changed a lot. I haven't done any work in this area for many years. I've transitioned or moved into a related but very different area. But at the time, I did a lot of work as bond counsel and underwriters counsel, mostly underwriters counsel. But all the organizations I worked for and disappeared. I did a lot of work for Kidder Peabody. I did a lot of work for E.F. Hutton. I did a lot of work for Bank One. I mean, it may appear to some people that maybe I shouldn't work for them because all these organizations I worked for ultimately went under. But it was interesting work at the time. It was very creative. We were, the single-family mortgage bond market was exploding, and we were creating new products all the time. So it was fun. It was a lot of fun, and did a lot of traveling. It changed. It changed. It used to be something that's still called the Red Book, but national firms could practice in different states, and then ultimately. Ultimately the local firms. I did a lot of work. I was bond counsel for Orange County, Florida, which is Orlando. Did a lot of work there. Did a lot of work in Palm Beach County, Monroe County, all these counties in Florida. And slowly but surely, the local firms pushed out the national firms and pushed out of bond counsel positions and ultimately out of the underwriters counsel position. So I view myself as very fortunate to have left that field and moved into another field where a lot of the people that I had worked with on single-family mortgage bonds ultimately ended up moving over to trading, sales and trading of derivative securities. And so I made the transition with them to derivative securities, and that's what I do now.
Okay. Just ask briefly about muni bonds during this period. In 1983, the Washington Public Power Supply System defaulted famously on mm-hmm. $2 billion worth of bonds, which raised a lot of questions about the industry. Were you working on muni bonds at that time?
83, yes.
Yeah. So do you recall that having an impact on your work at all, or was it sort of isolated?
Well, it suffused everything. I mean, we just everybody paid more attention to disclosure after that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Another big bond-related issue during this period was industrial revenue bonds. Were you working on these types of things at all?
Yes. It wasn't a major part of my practice, but I was involved in some of those.
Okay. All right. Let's see. So in 1989, the SEC adopted Rule 15C2-12, which required underwriters to obtain and review an issuer's official statement before there was any big issue of municipal securities. Did that have any big impact on your work, or were you even working on bonds by that point?
By that point, I was pretty much out of municipal securities, out of municipal securities practice, into more of a structured finance practice with derivatives. Even though nobody really had a derivatives practice then, a lot of the people that I worked with on single family mortgage bonds were doing all kinds of swaps and things like that, and I was focusing more on that than I was on ESPN securities.
Okay, so you started in the 1980s to work on structured finance.
late 80s.
Yeah. Okay. What was it like at that time, and how did it differ from today?
Oh, just in terms today, I mean, everything was brand new. We were doing documents from scratch. So now you have, you know, most of the documentation, you start off with well-negotiated, thought-out basic documents that, you know, that have been created through the ISDA, International Securities. So, it's, you know, using the ISDA documents as a basis, you know, that's where you, that's the starting point. And then everything you, it's just a contract, but you negotiate the special provisions.
Okay. Did the savings and loan crisis impact structured finance at all?
The savings and loan crisis, it didn't. What it did was there was a crazy period in 1984 and 85 when people were able to use FSLIC to guarantee multifamily bonds. And and I think it was 1985 and 1986, they finally put a stop to it. But it was just so many things that the IRS did. They said it was going to end on December 31st. And so for 4 or 5 months, everybody did tons of deals, probably deals that, you know, it shouldn't have been done, et cetera, but for the guarantee of FSLIC, which only exacerbated the abuses that were going on. And there were a lot of deals that were done. Of course, all my clients were responsible, so
absolutely,
responsible citizens, so I don't think we did many of those.
Okay. Yeah. So in 1990, you moved over to Jones Day.
Yes.
Where you are today.
Yes.
There, have you worked exclusively on structured finance issues?
Yes, pretty much.
Uh-huh. And yes. Derivatives work also?
Yes.
Okay. So what was the state of those industries in the early 1990s?
Oh, just developing. I mean, the first thing, in truth, if you track back, the single-family mortgage bonds, all kinds of devices were created that are still being used in mortgage-backed securities, or were used in mortgage-backed securities when there was a market for mortgage-backed securities, which hopefully will come back. But, you know, the accelerated payments and term bonds and tender options, all those things were baked into the single-family mortgage bond structures, and those were transmuted to mortgage-backed securities, and ultimately to CDOs and CLOs and things like that.
Mm-hmm. At the end of the 1990s, the long-term capital management collapse was a real threat to global finance. How did you experience that collapse, or were you just watching it from afar?
Because there was a rational solution in the end, the threat never materialized into serious harm. And I think maybe we all should have taken more instruction from it, but it really didn't impact the markets that much in the end.
Mm-hmm. What about other issues, I guess, around this period, like Enron? Enron at this point was using these special purpose entities. So did that happen? And that ended up becoming something of a problem for them. What impact did that have on the securitization practice?
It had significant impact on how we looked at transactions. I think it sobered everybody in terms of the type of transactions that people were willing to do. I think it had a significant impact.
Mm-hmm.
I think it helped. But it's like everybody, it's like, not an original thought, but it seems on the finance front, people sometimes have short memories. I mean, how do we, move from Enron to the problems we've had recently in 2008 on the mortgage securities, and hopefully we've learned our lesson and won't repeat it.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall the point at which you realized that there was going to be, a crisis in mortgage-backed securities or in the securities area?
I don't think there's a single point.
Well, Mark, are you still working at all on municipal securities?
I have kept my hand in one very specialized area, which overlaps the structured finance area that I've been focused on. And that is representing money market funds, large money market funds, in reviewing new municipal securities products. And that, to me, is fun because I still have a very special place in my heart and brain for municipal securities. So while I'm not involved at all in the regulatory aspect of it, we do review any new product that they look at to buy, and we do it from A to Z. The money market funds are very, very careful about products that they buy. They do not rely on the rating agencies, and they never did, nothing to do with recent developments. They just always want to be certain that the concerns that they have can be managed and that they can monitor the products. So at this point in time, part of my practice is to review these products. And for me, it's like coming home in a sense.
Okay. We're going to cover one last matter here. Mark, how did the different constituencies of the MSRB react to the enforcement of the rules that the board had put in place?
That was really an interesting phenomenon. They actually reacted very differently, both on the major division between securities firms and banks, and then within the banking community, they reacted differently. The banks, particularly those that were subject to the rules and examinations by the Comptroller of the Currency and the Federal Reserve, were very, very upset if they were ever found to be in violation of any of the MSRB rules, even on a technical basis. For example, if they were being written up for a violation of the record-keeping rules, they would strive, first of all, they would correct it, but they would also strive to try to get us involved in talking to regulatory authorities that they were not in violation. In contrast, the securities firms had a much more laissez-faire approach to these types of regulatory examinations. If they got cited for a record keeping, they say, okay, we'll fix it. They just didn't care that much about the winners concerned. I think the difference was that senior management at the banks would be reviewing any comments made, any adverse comments made by the regulatory authorities, and the people online did not want these kind of reports going to senior management. There was much more accountability for compliance with regulatory matters in the banks. And then among the three banks, there was a lot of difference. The Comptroller of the Currency was very active both in the rulemaking, in involvement in the rulemaking process and assistance to the board, and as was the Federal Reserve, the FDIC, which managed smaller banks, which also had fewer securities dealers embedded in them, paid less attention.
Well, Mark, looking back over your long career, do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
No, it's been an interesting and varied career, and I've had a lot of fun and met a lot of nice people along the way, and I think I've been very fortunate.
Okay, well, Mark Sosiski, we thank you very much for your time.
Yeah.